hope you're doing well. You're listening to the Arts Report on CITR 101.9 FM. I am your host, Sairao Unju, and we're broadcasting live from UBC's Point Grey campus on the unceded ancestral and traditional Musqueam territory in Vancouver. Also, I forgot to say that I'm in CITR station, but I feel like that's a given since it's live. Can you tell that I haven't been in the studio in a hot minute? Well, I think that brings me to my point. I know it's January 26th, but Happy New Year! Today is our first show of the year, first show of 2022, and I feel like I had to wish you a new Happy New Year, because if I don't, it just won't feel right. Like, it won't feel like this is the first show of the year. And now it has. And with that, I'll let you know what we have prepared for you today. Today we have three interviews and a review. So I'm going to list these in no particular order. This is not the order you will be hearing them in. I actually don't know what order I'm going to be playing in, so it'll be a surprise for the both of us. It's going to be exciting. So one of the interviews is with Lane Gillis for the Rocky Horror Show that Studio 58 will be putting starting February. And Lane plays Riff Raff. Other interview is with Laura Adamo, writer, director, and producer, and star of the feature film The Wishing Tree. Our last interview is with Lisa Baldistera, who is a curator, and Dion and Lisa will be talking about the exhibition that Lisa curated. And our only review of the day is Broadcasts From Here that Silvana very kindly reviewed. All of these are pre-recorded, which means I will be popping in and out between these things, but you will not be hearing too much of me, which might be exciting for some, or I don't know, maybe you like hearing me talk, so maybe you should tune in on the upcoming weeks to hear me talk more. I feel like that was a pretty good shameless plug. No? Yeah? No? Okay, so are we feeling an interview, a review? I think we're feeling an interview, right? Okay. What we're going to do, we're going to start with an interview, and then we're going to go into our quick ad and PSA, and then we will be back. But until that, I just, you know, I wish you happy listenings, and I hope you enjoy this interview. Is it just me, or can you not hear the interview? This is very...
Hi, Laura.
Okay, here it is.
Hello, I'm Ruby Raven with CITR, and I'm here today with Laura Adamo, the writer, director, producer, and star of The Wishing Tree, which won the Audience Choice Award at the Filmocracy Fest Film Festival and is currently available on all video on-demand platforms. Hi, Laura. Thank you for being here with me today. Congratulations on the film. I watched it last night and it was really great. I could really feel that you put your heart and soul into the film.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So I guess my first question is, I read a little bit about, you know, your little blurb that you wrote about why you made the film, but I'm wondering if you could tell me what inspired you to make the film.
I think it just started as a sort of cathartic experience for me, and just to write a story to help process some deep pain that I had lived through. And then it just ended up, you know, it's sort of Murphy's Law, right? It someone ended up reading it, they liked the script, and financing came in, and that's how we ended up getting to set. I wasn't initially set to direct it because I had never directed anything before, but my director, right when we started pre-production, sort of pulled me aside. He came from the music documentary world, and this would have been his first scripted feature. And he just thought he thought, you know, it's such a personal story. It's your story. You have such a strong vision for it. And I think people are going to be looking to you on set for guidance regardless. And I think it, maybe you might want to think about sort of stepping into your power and directing this. And I thought, oh my God, I've never directed anything. I'm not sure about that. Yeah. So we had some conversations with my producers, and after some back and forth, they encouraged me to do the same. And so that's how that happened.
That's so lovely. That must have felt really good to be working with producers and people who you were creating this film with, that it not only said, okay, I'll let you do this, but actually encouraged you to do this. Why did you think that they decided to pick your film?
I would have to say, I think because it's so deeply personal, I feel like that probably had something to do with it. And also, you know, it's funny the way the world works. Like when you're not necessarily trying to do something, it ends up, I mean, I've, you know, pitched several things in my world as a actor and a storyteller. And, you know, we shot a pilot, my writing partner and I, for City TV years ago, and sort of almost hit that home run. And, you know, it's an industry fraught with that. So for me, I was detached from the outcome, I guess. And I just thought, well, here we go. All right, sure. You want to read the script? Here you go. Like, I'm not a writer, so I don't know.
Oh, so you didn't write this with any intention, with any career aspirations? Was it purely just a therapeutic exercise?
You know, I think you always have that hope, exactly. Like maybe, you know, maybe this one. But for me, the primary reason, I would say, was as a cathartic kind of experience. Mm-hmm. Just sort of, but you know, making the film, there were several layers of that. Then there's the onset, the actual acting of it and directing of it, and then the editing of it, and then putting it out into the world, and, you know, bracing yourself, because some people are going to like it, some people aren't, and that's okay. That has to be okay.
Must have been really scary to be so vulnerable. I mean, it's not like you don't meet the people that are watching the film, but, you know, you're working with people so closely who maybe you just met, actors and stuff who didn't know you personally while these experiences were happening. So how did you cope with the vulnerability of putting something so personal out there directly with the people that you were working with?
I think a big benefit for me was that, like, speaking of my actor self and just the places I had to go, it was a huge benefit being the director, because I did not have time to question my instinct as an actor, which is often the kiss of death. Like, and because we were a true low budget indie, I didn't have copious amounts of takes. Like I did, I would say, almost every single shot in one take, because I wanted to give the guys, if there was any extra time on set, I wanted to give them a couple extra takes, because mm-hmm. they're coming to it new, right? So for me, it was sort of go or die time, like when it was action. And that was very, very liberating, because it allowed me to jump in 110%, not hold back at all. And, you know, not have any regrets about that.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing as an actor. I'm an actor too, so I know that there's so much second guessing. So to have that stripped away must have been, as you say, super liberating. And, you know, as I was watching it, I really felt Julia's sorrow. And then at the end, I actually like took a breath, like I felt that relief. So I'm wondering, you know, where, you know, you and Julia are sort of, you know, combined. So I'm wondering how you prepared for the role. Like, were there any major differences, or were you like playing yourself, or how did you deal with that?
No, definitely not myself, but I, you know, because I'm not in my real life. Well, I'm a pretty stoic person. I've learned how to deal with a lot of things. And I tend to be more insular in dealing with them on my own, which I suppose is somewhat of a similarity there with her, but she's definitely harder. And the challenge I had I would say as the actor was, how do I, you know, I don't want to sugarcoat her grief. And I didn't want to, I wanted to make it as real as possible, because it really is fertility issues for females are, it's rampant and it's devastating and it's very raw and painful. So I felt like a real commitment to honor that and not to gloss over that. And then the actor part of you knows that at some point there's got to be something compelling. It can't just be her sorrow and her grief. So that was a line that I, you know, did my best to find, because you have to like characters too. You have to root for them. But, you know, at the end of the film, if you can at least just exhale for her and know that, you know, she's going to be okay, and care that she's going to be okay, then I feel like, you know, maybe I did my job.
No, and I did feel that at the end. Like, I was watching it with my dad, and I just like took a breath, and I was like, oh my God, I really feel her relief here. And especially because there was so much sorrow and grief happening, and I really did dive into that with Julia. So that was really cool to feel that with her.
Thank you. Yeah. Anyway.
Sorry, there's a Zoom delay. Sorry, you're gonna say something.
No, go ahead.
Okay. So you were talking about, you know, putting the director hat on, not having time to second guess yourself as an actor. And as I was watching some of those, you know, beautiful shots in the forest, I was wondering, you know, who are your director inspirations? Did you have any directors that you looked to or thought of when you were planning out the directing and the takes of each scene?
Right. I would say I looked to Jean-Marc Vallée. God bless him. It's so sad that he is no longer here. Not just because of the Wild reference, which, you know, it's a woman in the woods trying to find but because I love his style of just letting, you know, it never appears to be about the perfection of the framing or the scene. It's always about giving the scene enough breath for the actors to move and not be restricted. So we really tried to do that a lot. And I think we were, you know, the fact that we shot in the woods and had that just natural, beautiful topography to work with was it was extremely difficult. Like, I broke my hand day 3 of the shooting, had a cast, then had to write that into the film. And then,
oh my God, that you wrote that into the film?
Did we had to. And so that was interesting. We're shooting pretty much chronologically, so we were able to work it in, and then we wrote the additional scene where it's wrapped and, you know, before the campfire scene. And I mean, it was just all the stuff in the city was shot after the fact, so that we had to just hide and shoot around it, which was interesting, but easier to do because we were in a contained environment. Like, we were on set, you know, harder to do when you're in the woods. But yeah, Jean-Marc, I think he's just, I just love, you know, there's that scene in Dallas Buyers Club in the grocery store where it's like, in its imperfection, it's perfect because you just allow for space. You allow for some sort of spontaneity. It was never about, oh, this shot looks the most perfect. It was about the feeling. Like, how do I feel when I watch this take as opposed to this take, even though this take might have been a little more perfectly sort of executed, you know? And that's probably the actor in me making those decisions, coming to it as, you know, directing, that it was always about, and my editor was very on board with that. Like, how does it make us feel? Like, what's the hit there? But I would say I didn't have a lot of time, right? Because we were in pre-production when this sort of got put on my lap that I would be directing it. So I look forward to the next project where I can have much more time to prepare and to actually draw inspiration from a number of different sources. But I kind of had to pick, like, okay, who's one of my favorite directors? Whose work do I love? And I'm gonna read interviews with this person, you know, in the 5 minutes of spare time I have in a day during pre-production. So that's sort of who I went with.
Wow. So you really did actually choose someone to sort of be your leader in this. And it was Jean-Marc.
Yeah, for me, it was like, I just, it was I've always loved his work, and just the reference of like, how did he shoot in, I mean, very different, obviously, I'm not comparing my film to Wild, but other than the fact that it's shot in nature on a hiking trail, but there was a lot to sort of pull from that. Mm-hmm. Even though that's over a very long period of time, my film's over, you know, 2 days. And just how he works with actors, how he deals with actors, how his stuff is just raw and real. And for me, I thought if I could achieve some beautiful, authentic moments with the actors in this film, then, you know, hopefully we cobble together something that's worth watching, right?
Yeah, and speaking of the other actors in the film, obviously the characters of Caleb and Ryan are really important to Julia's journey. So I'm wondering what went into the casting process, like what was important to you in terms of the actors and those characters?
That's a good question. So again, I think as an actor, you know, I can only approach directing through my actor lens because that's what I am primarily. And I remember getting into it with my producer. He was like, what are you looking for? You know, and I was like, I will know it when I see it. I'll know it when I feel it. Like I know we had great actors come in that could technically execute everything, but just something, you know. So the role of Ryan, he was the first one cast in the film, and he is an actor that I actually knew beforehand. We still had a big casting session for it, but there was just something about, from the first moment I met him, I remember thinking, God, if I ever make that film, like this is my Ryan. Because he just had the ethos of it. Like just, you just know instinctively. Right. It's like how you move as an actor, right? Where to go next. It's like that's mm-hmm. For me, I'm not a super technical actor. I'm much more instinctual, probably because I learned in theater and that's how I was taught. And that's just how my instrument works. Mm-hmm. The Caleb character, he was the last person to be cast, and it was incredibly stressful because we were going to set literally in 4 days and we had no Caleb. Mm-hmm. And I ended up finding him on IMDb, and we reached out to his agent, and I literally reached out to the agent just on a whim because he trained at the same theater school as me in New York. And I thought, okay, so there'll probably be a shorthand in terms of us being on set, which we needed because we didn't have a lot of time, but maybe there was a story. He had sort of a little bio, and he had experienced some tragedy. He lost his twin sister tragically years earlier. And I just thought, you know, there has to be that lived experience in that actor. And so, yeah, as soon as he and I connected and met, I was like, okay, this is him. So he literally flew in from LA because he lives out there. And the next day we were doing a table reading and doing, fittings, but it was stressful. I was like, oh my God, I don't have like my number two on my call sheet. We're going to set in 4 days.
Oh my God. It sounds like, you know, making a film is so hard, and it sounds like for a lot of this, you were very instinctual in terms of, you know, your acting and your directing. And I know how hard it is to get a film made. It's really, really, really hard. That's a feat in and of itself. So I'm wondering like what the process was. You said you wrote it, you know, sort of just for yourself, and then people wanted to take a look at it. But do you have any advice for young filmmakers on how they can get their film made?
God, it's such a, you know, it's funny because I sit here and I think myself, and I just made a feature that's coming out. I think, how the hell am I going to do this again? Like, how do things align, right? And I would say one of the things I learned, one of the biggest lessons I learned on this is when you're pushing too hard, it's a sign that you need to step back and allow the next right step to come to you, or the answer to come to you. Mm-hmm. As often, and I am super guilty of that because I'm ambitious and there's a lot I want to do. But often when we're busy pushing, you know, the boulder up the mountain, we're missing maybe what's meant to happen.
Yeah.
And I think that I'm going to take my own advice, like with my next project, when things get hard, to just sort of trust, take a step aside and just wait, right? Because what I learned in this process, because all I had was I had no experience to guide me in terms of the directing. All I had was my instinct. So I had to rely on that. I didn't have, you know, oh yeah, well, when on my last project, this is what happened. And often when I hit a wall and didn't know what to do, if I just took a breath and trusted that the right answer would come, it all, or the problem would solve itself miraculously, it always did. And so I think that's a good lesson, you know. Even, I mean, my film was financed privately by an investor. And then I had met, you know, the head of Telefilm years earlier, and he reached out and said, you know, are you going to apply for money for Telefilm? And I was like, okay, that's like needle in a haystack, but we made the film. And he said, well, why don't you apply for some post-production money? And we were trying to license a song that was expensive and had all these other expenses, because you always, you know, it's hard to do a film for that kind of money. And so we did, just on a whim, and I had to sort of fight a little bit to get that application in, because it's a lot of work. And everyone was like, you're never going to get it. You're never going to get it. No one gets money. And we ended up getting that last bit of money from Telefilm, right? So just like things like just following your flow, right? Even if people are telling you it's crazy, if it feels like the next right thing to do, then do it. And if it feels like not inspired and you're moving up, you're trying to move upstream, then maybe take a step back and just trust that there's another way, and it will present itself if you give it the space to and allow it.
Wow. Do you have any plans to make a next film? Are you working on anything now?
I do. I have, it's funny, I have a project that I was writing sort of at the same time as this, but it's quite, it's a different, it's not what I'm feeling. I mean, we've all lived through this crazy pandemic, and I think trauma, everyone, that I'm feeling a little darker. So I'm actually writing, it's a film that I started writing, I'm halfway through it. It's a psychological thriller, which I never thought I would write or even want to do, but I'm feeling compelled. That's an example of that, right? Like, this lovely, beautiful story that I was writing before, I'm like, I feel like I'm forcing it right now. So I've switched gears, and I'm like, I never thought I'd go back to this film, because I was just writing to see if I could write, and I'm feeling compelled to finish that. And as such, I have, a director who's quite a renowned Canadian director who wants to collaborate with me. And I'm like, on this particular piece. And I was like, okay, now I just need to finish the script. Yeah. And, you know, we'll see, like, maybe that's going to transpire, maybe it's not, but to just sort of allow for space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just switching gears here for a second. In one of the last scenes, there's a scene with a little boy. And I thought to myself, is that her real son? And I looked you up on Instagram, and I saw that it was. And there was something about that scene. Normally, when you're watching a film, you'd think, oh, it's just a child actor. But I really, was it your son?
It is my son, yeah.
There was just something, there was just like a sort of playfulness and joy that I was like, this is her real son. I don't know why I've never thought that when I'm watching a movie. But there was like this, it was such a short scene, but it was just like this connection you guys had. So That was really lovely. And I'm wondering what compelled you to want to put him into the film.
I don't know. It's sort of like an ode to my son, the film, really, because it was 5 years to bring him into the world. And I mean, this is the part that makes me emotional. I could cry. So having said that, I had the scene perfectly planned in my mind. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Like, it was one of the scenes that I knew, this is how this scene's going to go. Like, from the shot to the, like, even meeting with my DP, I'm like, no, this is how this scene has to go. And it didn't go anything like that. It was without a doubt my most stressful day on set. Wow. A total disaster, because my son kept, he had a line, and he's, you know, he kept pointing to the camera. It was the day we had our gym. So like the crane shot, right? And he's like pointing and smiling, looking at the camera. And then he's pointing at my on-set photographer who had a wacky mustache, going, mommy, look at that guy's mustache. Like, I mean, all he had to do was stand there from behind, look at the tree and say, mama, is that the wish? Couldn't do it, right? So we literally got to the editing room, and I was like, oh my God, am I going to have to cut? Like, I'm gonna have to cut my kid from the film. Okay. And then we just kept reworking it. My editor and I, we found a way to make it work. Cause I was like, I feel like you know, the filmmaker in me and the mom in me as well. I was like, I really would like to make, but I had to, like, another example, I had to abandon everything I thought that scene would be. Right. I had to throw it out the window and literally start from scratch and say, is there any way to make this work? You know? Mm-hmm. And when he sort of stares down the barrel of the lens, like, that was a very intentional choice to break that fourth wall of, like, you know, sort of seeing into the future, like, this kid is coming for you kind of thing in this flashback. So, or flash forward, I should say, in that moment. So, but that was, yeah, it was, I the day we were on set, I'm not gonna lie, I regretted it. And you can feel the tension of the crew, right? They're like, oh my God, we can't say anything. It's the director, it's her kid, it's this. And I know it's not going well at all, right? Like, so, yeah, working with children is tricky.
Yeah, especially when it's your own. Yeah. But yeah, I do have to say, I really, that was probably one of my favorite scenes. And like I said, I've never ever thought, that kid, is that actor's real child? But I really, really did think that there was just something about the chemistry between the two of you. So just wrapping up here, I just have two more questions. We see, you know, the flash forward for Julia, but where do you envision that her life goes once she leaves the woods?
I don't know if she actually gets together with her husband again. Like, I sort of saw her as just having this child, that she has this child on her own, and it is her own terms, and it's not like a perfect, oh, and then she goes back to her husband. Like, I never, in my idea of it, that was never in my head. I don't know, but you know, it's funny because people can interpret it however they want, but in my mind, she just finds a way to have this child, to bring this child into the world, and it's kind of the two of them, right?
That's what I felt too, in that scene. Like, there was a freedom and a joy and a camaraderie, and it was like just the two of them in their little world. So I mean, that's how I interpreted it, obviously.
Oh, cool.
Sounds like we had similar interpretations of where her life went. And my final question is, as I said at the beginning of the interview, you won an audience award at the Filmography Fest Film Festival. So I'm wondering, what do you hope that audiences, people like me watching it at home with my family, what do you hope that we take away from this film?
To me, it's about finding hope in your darkest moments. It's trusting, sorry, that's me. It's trusting that that in your darkest moments, again, that surrendering into them, that beauty can be found, mm-hmm. right? And that, you know, I go back to, again, the 2 years that we've all sort of lived through, that where's the light and where's the silver lining, and that, you know, the tagline to me really is the film. It's like, sometimes hope is really found in the most unexpected ways and places, and that we always have to have hope, right? And I hope that it's hopeful, because it's quite, you know, it's quite an intense movie at times. And so my hope is that you get to the ending of it and you can somehow find hope in whatever your challenge is or your journey is in the moment. Mm-hmm. Because wow. No one lives through this world without some amount of suffering, right? And pain. Like,
yeah, and if they do, it's horrible. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining me today and spending this past 30 minutes talking to me. Your film was really amazing, and I can't wait to watch your next one.
Thank you. And thank you so much for watching and for having me. I really appreciate it. It's been fun.
Of course. Have a great day.
You too. Take care.
You too. Bye.
Discorder Magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, Discorder lives. Your favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder Magazine or at rickshawtheater.com.
Discorder, that free magazine from CITR, has been documenting the best in music, arts, and culture since 1983. Let's see what one man of prestige has to say about Discorder.
What up, though? This is Big Snoop Dogg, and I fucks with Discorder magazine. How about that?
Smoke you every day. Pick up a copy around Vancouver or fuck with Discorder online at discorder.ca.
Hello. Hi, we're back. I love that Snoop Dogg ad so much. It's amazing, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. And I also hope you enjoyed that interview with Laura Adamo. Next up, we have, yes, another interview. So we're going to play our interview with Lane Gillis, who is playing Riff Raff in the Rocky Horror Show. And you'll get to hear all about it in just a second. Enjoy. Hello, everyone. Today, I have with me Lane Gillis, who is playing Riff Raff on the new production that Studio 58 is doing, and they're doing the Rocky Horror Show. Hi, Lane. Welcome.
Hi.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
I'm really excited to talk to you about the Rocky Horror Show because it's a classic. It's a cult classic, and I'm so excited that you guys are producing this year. And
me too.
Hopefully, you'll be able to actually perform it live, which will be amazing. So for anyone who doesn't know, can you tell us what the Rocky Horror Show is about?
Yeah, absolutely. it's a very interesting show. I remember my first time watching it, I was like, what? But basically, it's about this very ordinary couple who get engaged and then are going to tell their friends and get stuck with a flat tire in the middle of the woods, and they have to go look for a telephone. And they end up at this otherworldly castle, and they meet Frankenfurter, who's like the main person, and are basically on this journey into this crazy, intense, amazing, I don't even know how to describe it. Like, otherworldly is like the best way I can describe it, experience. It's so much fun. It's got a lot of rock and roll, and yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. And if anyone from the audience who hasn't seen the original movie, I definitely recommend, especially if you're going to see the show, because I feel like it gives a good idea of what to expect, because you don't really know what to expect when you hear the Rocky Horror Show as a title.
No, not at all. And I know it's been around for so long, and my mom's been quoting it for ages, and I didn't really have any idea what she was quoting, but then I watched it and I was like, oh.
So you're playing the character Riff Raff, who is described as a handyman in the opening credits of the original movie. If you were to use one word to describe Riff Raff besides a handyman, what would you choose?
Ooh, that's a really great question. I would say, I want to say eccentric, but they're all eccentric. Riff Raff is rock and roll, I think. Whatever that means to you, that's what he is.
That's a great answer. And so for your role as Riff Raff, are you studying the movies? Because there are two versions, the original 1975 one, and they also remade it in 2016. Are you studying either of the two versions of Riff Raff, or are you working solely off of the script that you were given?
Well, actually, our director, Josh Epstein, as soon as we go out our casting, he was basically like, don't watch the movie. These are your characters now. So, but you know, having watched the movie and being in love with Riff Raff, I have had some like preconceived ideas of him, but I've been trying, I haven't watched it since. So I've been taking kind of what the script has and a little bit of what I remember from the movie, and then trying to put my own thing on it, because it's such a classic movie. I'm hoping not to do more of like a copy of Riff Raff, but bring a new essence to him.
And I've never seen the Rocky Horror Show as a stage production, so I don't know how much it actually differs from the movie. Could you, as a person who is studying the production to do it on stage, and also as someone who has seen the movie beforehand, Can you tell us kind of the parts where you saw some differences or some things that you think are significant for the stage production that you might not see in the movie?
Mm-hmm. Well, they're actually not too different from what I remember, because originally it was a stage, like made for the stage in the theater. Mm-hmm. And then watching the movie, I was actually quite surprised at how similar it was. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely because, I mean, in the movie, they get to play so much with these ray guns and with this sci-fi, all this stuff, creating Rocky, and they get to, you know, use editing and all that stuff for mm-hmm. that. So it's really fun seeing how we can do that for the stage in a live setting. It's going to be with a lot of amazing, like, from the set. Shizuka Kai is doing the set, and it looks awesome. So there's a lot of fun stuff incorporated in that that we get to play with. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and in the costumes as well. Donny Chijani is doing the costumes. We're doing a lot with that to make it a little different from what the film has already given.
Okay. And I also read that you have experience in stage combat. And mm-hmm. does this come in handy for this production at all? Will we see you at some level of doing stage combat?
There's not too much stage combat, I mean, that I know of yet. We're still, mm-hmm. Maybe I can swing one in, but it's a lot more dancing and choreography in that style, which is also super fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you guys have different rehearsals for the dancing, or do you kind of do the, you know, like the blocking and the just the scenes with the dancing together? How does that work?
Yeah, so far they've been separate. So we've been doing, and I mean, because it's a musical, most of it is mm-hmm. Dancing and singing. So we've been doing a lot of like learning the songs and then learning the dance and then applying those together. And then we'll do like the scenes separately. But we've been doing them out of order because there's so many songs and dances.
Oh yeah, there are so many.
Yeah, so piecing together has been quite the ride.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll end up great.
Yeah.
So I remember last year productions, the actors were keeping their social distance between each other. So I'm wondering, has that changed for this year? I don't really know the restrictions when it comes to stuff like this, because I can't imagine producing a show that has a song called Toucha Toucha Touch Me without actually touching each other.
Yeah, that would be very challenging. No, so as far as I know, we're able to be in closer proximity than 6 feet, but we have to be masked, and a lot of people are double masking and mm-hmm. and making sure, and basically along with the college, if we have any symptoms at all, even if it's just like a minor headache, we're just not supposed to come in. So I think that's what's making it okay to be a little bit closer in proximity mm-hmm. for that. But yeah, at this point I'm a little used to it, because most of the shows I've been doing in the last little bit have been, you know, masked and distance. But mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm excited for that, to do it. You know, how we previously did it before, but it's kind of a fun challenge at this point.
Yeah. And how long have you been at studio for?
This will be my third year, so I'm in my last semester now.
Oh my god, you're almost there. You're graduating.
I know, so I'm so exciting. Close. I'm happy this is a show I'm leaving with, you know, or one of the shows.
Oh my god, yeah, that's such a good thing to do in your last year.
Yeah,
so you spent 2 out of 3 years at studio in a pandemic, doing mm-hmm. all theater things with distancing or masking up, or, you know, basically not what we were used to.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, this is gonna take a little long, but I'm gonna get to my question in a second. So you know how, like, in normal life after 2 years we can't remember how, like, we used to not wear masks outside going to restaurants, or like how restaurants were set or how close people used to sit each other, and now, like, what we're doing right now feels normal and we can't really remember what it was like. Do you mm-hmm. think there are aspects in theater that feels like has been this for you forever? So does it feel the same with theater? Is there something that you can't remember ever not being normal?
Oh, like working with the masks and everything.
Yeah, just like,
yeah,
considering the last 2 years.
Yeah, I think I think it's been more so of like, oh, what parts of this are going to change the way that I act? Like, one of my things is like, oh, am I going to be like blank in the face after this, because I'm so used to a mask mm-hmm. covering my face most of the time and like using my body more so and that kind of thing. And definitely like it's becoming more of a common thing, which is super great, but like, you know, double checking if it's okay to mm-hmm. to have contact with someone. I can't imagine ever not doing that before, you know, like in scenes sometimes you're in it and you make an offer and what if it's, you know, making contact with someone and it works and it's like, oh, awesome. But mm-hmm. now it's like, I would never do that without making sure, you know, it's okay. Just because of COVID and because of boundaries and everything as well. So that's, I think, one of the things for sure for me.
Wow. Okay. And so going back to your role as Riff Raff. So Riff Raff is played by men in both of the movie versions. Mm-hmm. And so for this stage production, are you playing Riff Raff as a man yourself, or are you guys turning him into a woman? How is the that dynamic working for you?
Mm-hmm. So I've just been more playing around because he's an alien, so mm-hmm. he's not technically human.
That's true.
I've been playing around with the fact of more just like this gender fluid character, mm-hmm. I think. Like, I'm hoping that the audience doesn't really perceive Riff Raff as a specific male or specific female, essentially. Mm-hmm. And because Riff Raff's an alien, I think there's a lot of room in that. But that is something within this production that we've been playing around a little bit with. It is like gender, what is gender? Mm-hmm. kind of thing, especially in this time, and putting it on now with this modern audience, that's more of a conversation we've had. And with these characters, you know, it's so easy to be able to dive into that kind of thing.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting, actually. I feel like what you're doing with the, you know, hoping that and trying to make him be perceived as more of an alien and not really a man or a woman, because I feel like our minds really go to, you know, oh, gender, and then mm-hmm. but we don't know if aliens have genders, who knows?
Well, exactly. I've had to like create this whole backstory of what their planet is and what's normal there and everything, and it's just like, why be, you know, simplified just to the gender of what, you know, the character is like. Yeah. There's so much that can be explored within this character too.
Yeah. Oh my god. So wait, how is your process for creating a backstory for a character you're playing?
It's been a lot of talking with one of my castmates, Magenta, mm-hmm. Played by Colton Ludwar. They and I have just been going back and forth like, oh, what if it's this, what if it's this, and that's been really helping me. And then going through the script and like, okay, what can we take from this? Even though the script is very, it's all over the place in the best way. So it's really taking something and then stretching it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like describing the Rocky Horror Picture Show as all over the place in a good way is such a good way to describe it.
Yeah. I agree.
And would you like to remind everyone when they can see you in the Rocky Horror Show and how they can get tickets?
Yes. So the Rocky Horror Show, it runs February 3rd to 20th. And you can get your tickets online. If you could look up Studio 58 or Langara College, there'll be a section. You can go to it and reserve your tickets, buy your tickets. I would highly recommend doing it sooner than later, because right now we are at 50% capacity, mm-hmm. so they are selling out pretty fast.
Good to know. Thank you so much. Well, Lane, thank you. It was great talking to you about the Rocky Horror Show, and I'm so excited to see the show and see you in it, too. Thank you so much.
Yay! Thank you so much.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
the CM, the CIA, think I'm Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, the CM, the CIA, and the Skakulia, to lead in, who must we must stay.
Ta-ta!
Now the patriarchy is dead, and we killed it. If you identify as a woman, femme, trans, or non-binary, CITR wants you on the air. You can talk about literally whatever you want as long as you care about it. No worries if you have no experience, we'll train you in everything you need to know. Come by CITR and say hi.
Hey.
Hi.
Hello.
From 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday to Friday to help us never play Led Zeppelin on CITR 101.9 FM ever again. I could be you.
Hello. Hi. Don't forget to say hi to CITR. So we're back, but we're not done. We have, yes, you guessed it, another interview for you. So this interview is one Dion did, and if you don't know, I just want to give a shout out to Dion because they're currently in France doing like a year, 2 years abroad, but they're still contributing to CITR, which is really cool, and I really appreciate it. And I'm not sure we're actually be listening to our review this week or not, so you know, keep listening and you'll see if you'll get to hear a review or not. Yeah, but for now, enjoy the interview.
Hello, this is Dion for the Arts Report, and I recently had an interview with the curator from Griffin Arts Project, Lisa Baldicera, about the upcoming Gerd Metzdorf collection. Gerd Metzdorf was an art collector and also a flight steward, and this is the first public exhibition of his private collection since his passing. And it is it's an excellent collection of European and North American art, mostly focused on photography. And it's actually part of the upcoming Capture Photography Festival. It has almost a MoMA quality to it. That's how good the collection is. And it is completely free, and anyone can visit to book 30-minute slots on griffinartproject.ca to visit. And yeah, here is my interview with Lisa Baldicera.
Okay, well, yeah, actually, I really wanted to do this interview because I read the press release, and it was just such a captivating like story. So for a listener who don't know, can you just tell us a little bit about this upcoming exhibition?
Yeah, absolutely. So the exhibition is being held at Griffin Art Projects, and I mentioned this because Griffin is founded by Henning and Brigida Freiby, who are collectors of national and international works themselves, and founded Griffin to highlight private collections, the work of private collections in the city. And Gerd Metzdorf and the Freibys met each other in the 1970s, and they co-founded the Contemporary Art Society Vancouver as a way to sort of maximize their connections and bring people from outside of Vancouver to Vancouver audiences. And this included, you know, incredible visitors like Robert Rauschenberg and John Chamberlain and Andy Warhol. And so it was like an incredible, and the Vogels, who were the New York collectors, were also part of that circle of people that he was in touch with. Gerd Metzdorf was a very retiring kind of person. In fact, I learned yesterday, actually, through the person who the collection is currently has been left to, his friend Grant Mann. And Grant told me that Gerd, in fact, was asked by Andy Warhol and Thomas Roof and Robert Mapplethorpe if they could do a portrait of him. And he was never wanted to be the center of attention or in the spotlight. And he declined these invitations, which is so hard to believe.
Oh, wow.
So, but we do have one image of Gert, and this is toward the end of his life, and this was taken by Christos de Kyakos, who is one of the leading figures of conceptual art in Vancouver. And so when you come into the exhibition, you'll see this image of Gert there amongst his collection. So we did manage to have one image of him in the show, despite he's a little camera shy.
Yeah, so the Mesdorf collection, from what I understand, is, you know, accumulated over the years throughout Gert's career as a flight steward. And it's very, I find it just very touching the way this idea that like a very shy, he's like you said, flight steward just collecting art over the years. And do you see any of that reflected in the collection itself?
You know, the collection itself is really confident and quite flamboyant in a way. Like, it really is far reaching from kind of more sort of strong conceptual German works that are, you know, quite formalist to pop art that is, you know, quite flamboyant, and, you know, some really quite edgy painting and drawing works and photography. So it's just, I think it's remarkable in that sense. Like, his approach was really to be supportive of artists and to follow his own interests and curiosities. And so in that sense, you know, it's unusual, because he didn't sort of choose a set of artists that he was going to follow. He really, in the 1970s, working for Canadian Airlines at that point, CP, Canadian Pacific Airlines, he started out with now defunct airline, but and used the per diems, those daily kind of amounts for subsistence that the airline would give him when he was on overlays, certain layovers. And so during these layovers, instead of doing that, he went and looked at art, and he bought art with these sort of modest means. And so he did catch some of these artists right at the beginnings of their careers, like Linda Benglis, who he became a supporter and friend to, and who's now a major figure. Internationally, not just as an American artist. And we have you know, a number of those anecdotal stories about his just real keen interest in the artists, in the thinking behind the work. You know, he really was engaged with it as a kind of area of cultural activity, creative work, creative thinking, and as his role at the Contemporary Art Society was as a programmer. So he would bring these folks in to do talks and to meet with people here. And really, it was to just kind of bring what he was discovering as he was doing his travels. So his major travels to Germany, but also to New York. So that was part of his ongoing kind of flights. He did the New York-Vancouver run, and then he was also in Dusseldorf and Cologne. And so during those trips, he would do these kind of you know, range to see work, range to visit galleries and see and visit artists wherever possible. So, you know, his collecting, the first work in his collection is a Li Ufan work, very early Ufan work. And then the latest in the collection, the very last work, was a small Richter work. So there's just an incredible range of works. So that first work is the work from 1973. So you can see that, you know, over 40 years, a lot of the artists gained in stature, and his instincts were proven right.
Well, as a curator, how do you go about even starting, like, to curate a collection that is so personal and, frankly, something that has such a huge range?
You know, that's a great question. Some of it is just, you know, visiting and getting to know him, because I unfortunately didn't get a chance to meet him before he passed away. Mm-hmm. So I've gotten to know him through talking with his friends and people who knew him. And then also looking at the collection itself, you can see the currents that go through them. And so in this exhibition, you'll see these sort of selections of works that are kind of vibrant and funny and edgy into these more serious works. And I've tried to represent sort of all of those streams that I saw and I felt in many ways that I was also getting to know him through those, you know, sort of sitting with the works. And one of the treats of installing work is then you also see other quieter connections that come into play once all of the work is assembled in the same room together. Then you start to see other connections forming. But yeah, there were those very strong streams of pop art, mm-hmm. conceptual work, very strong conceptual practice underpinning all of the work. And the work also has, most of it has a kind of formalist engagement while attending to this conceptual and theoretical concerns. So it's a really interesting combination.
Yeah, and the exhibition is titled Per Diem. And for a lot of people, I think contemporary art seems almost the opposite of that. It's very, for a lot of people in the public, it's quite inaccessible as a field, and it seems very detached. How does the collection challenge this idea? And like, how did he collect this collection, like day by day, kind of?
Well, you know, looking at it, I don't get a sense that the first thing that he was concerned with was investment. This was not, he wasn't collecting people that were mid-career, even late career. He was collecting people that were sort of in the midst of their work, early career. So my sense in looking at it was, and the way he started out, is for people to really have confidence in their curiosity about contemporary and to feel welcome. One of the things about Griffin is that we are free and open to the public. So anybody can come in, they can come in with their family, they can come in over and over again, they can come in to look at just one artwork, because it's all about accessibility and sharing. And that is definitely something that, from speaking with Gert's friends, it seems that he was very concerned with, like thinking about how to share this work, how to share the work through the Contemporary Art Society, sharing it with Vancouver audiences, sharing his connections with these artists. So the sense really is building a kind of cultural fabric, but really feeling like you're welcome to be part of that, that it's not an exclusive kind of conversation. It's a multifaceted, multicultural conversation that is growing. And, you know, if you have the curiosity and you have a little per diem or something like it that you can start with, you'll find that there are emerging artists here in Vancouver mm-hmm. that very similarly could really use that support and patronage. You know, so going to the master's and undergraduate exhibitions in the universities and art colleges here in the city, and getting to know all those students who will be present.
Yeah.
Is a way to start.
Yeah. I mean, collecting is a very crucial link in the art ecosystem for artists and galleries alike. And there's this, I think, interesting dynamic between like private collections and then making them, yet still making them public, like, and accessible. As a curator, coming to like a broader view on like the world we live in today with digital resources and virtual galleries and like nowadays like NFTs, what's the relationship between collecting art and like curating art?
Well, I mean, we have to thank a lot of collectors for preserving arts. Sometimes an artist might have not the resources or the means to preserve their work, and especially after they pass, you know, depending on how their wills are organized or how their executors work, sometimes works are just kind of diffused. They get all sold off and you don't have access to them or even know where they went. So you know, collectors can be part of that preservation of the work. Sometimes you'll find these little gems that are in collectors have acquired early on that might not even be known to the major museums. Like they can be kind of caretaking. They can have a caretaking space, as well as just the practical supports of artists' income and being able to continue to do their work. So those two things are hugely important. And often collectors with a kind of community-oriented vision will arrange to place their collections, to donate them in the major museums. And if you look at the history of a lot of our museums, that's exactly what's happened. Bequests like that, gifts like that, end up being the cornerstone for the beginning of a major collection. So, for example, Andrew Grafton, Claudia Beck's gift to the Vancouver Art Gallery really created this, you know, an enormous collection of photography, which now they can build on, mm-hmm. deepen, and it creates this kind of possibility for galleries who don't have big acquisition budgets. So those gifts are really important, especially now, actually, because the acquisitions budgets tend to be shrinking. So that's another kind of long-term goal of collecting.
Right. I think that's about all the questions I have, actually. Do you have anything you would like to add about the Metzdorf collection?
I would say it's a lot of fun. It's a really, I think people who come to see the show are going to find little surprises and little gems. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the work, as I mentioned, it ranges from that, you know, quite serious, solid conceptual work that's quite classical, and then into these very playful works that are, you know, engaging with, you know, the urban fabric, street art. So that it's, the range is just incredible. So if you want to have a really fun afternoon for free, come to Griffin Art Projects, North Vancouver. And also we'll also have a number of public programs online as well, also free via Zoom. So you can see those on our website as well at griffinartprojects.ca. So you'll see the number of, we'll have a panel discussion coming up where we're actually looking at what it means to begin a collection, like with a per diem. With a very modest beginning. And we'll also do a film. We're planning on screening a few films. One of them on the Vogels, who did that with their own savings as administrators, just starting small.
Mm, that's very good. Yeah, the Gert Metzdorf collection will be on from February 4th to May 8th. For all the listeners who are interested, feel free to drop by the Griffin Arts Project. Thank you, Lisa, so much for talking to me.
Thank you so much for your interest. It's wonderful. And I welcome everyone to come and see the show.
Hi. Hello. We're back. But we are also leaving at the same time because the end of this interview marks the end of our show. I know in the beginning I said that we had three interviews and a review, but it is currently 6:02. And unfortunately, we do not have time for Silvana's review. So tune in next week, February 2nd at 5 p.m. To hear Silvana's review. And not only that, but we also have Griffin's review. This will be his first time on the show, so little claps for him. And we also have another interview lined up with an author. So you know what? I'll talk to you next week. And until then, stay safe, y'all. You're made of angel and space dust. You're the only kind of smoke I know inside of my lungs. It's a riot, police car, siren burning in the streets, and I'm on the top part of it. Yeah, we can dance in the orange glow until the military comes down.
A pothole on a road. I got places to go. I got more rounds.
make a break. Pend in, pay attention. Juices blend in, never blend in. Fuck that shit, you got your own rough. Make a break, only myself to thank.